Hello, my name is Katie Wilkie. I am a research assistant at the Boston University School of Social Work Center for Addictions Research and Services. I have been a program manager there for the last 3 years, managing multiple SAMHSA CSAT-funded grants. And I'm presenting today with Emily Stewart, the executive director of Casa Esperanza, a community-based organization in Roxbury, and our other colleague, Diliana De Jesus, who's the deputy director of Casa Esperanza. And we're presenting on suicide ideation and suicide attempts in substance-using Latinos who are presenting to residential treatment. And we don't have any relationships to disclose. And so our learning objectives for today are really to identify patterns of suicidal ideation and suicide attempts in this population who are Latino, HIV positive, or at risk, and who are presenting for substance abuse treatment at a facility in Boston. And what we wanted to look at is the relationship and also the incidence of severe mental health symptoms, substance abuse history, and we will look also at sort of culturally relevant severe mental health and suicide interventions for Latinos. So today I'll just quickly go over our study and our data and our findings and then pass the mic over to Emily and Diliana, who will talk more about challenges and local approaches and policy implications for working with this population, as I'm sure a lot of you want something to take home with you. And so our community-based organization, Casa Esperanza, is in Roxbury, which is a few miles from here. It's 32% Hispanic Latino. It's a residential substance abuse facility serving Latino men and women. And it's 90% Latino and the 87% Puerto Rican. And our program is called Tu Bienestar. It's a SAMHSA CSAT-funded TCE, Targeted Capacity Expansion HIV program. And so CASA is really filling this critical gap in services. They offer bilingual, bicultural services to this population. So they're really at the cutting edge of what's happening in the Latino substance-using population in the area. I'm sorry about this slide. The pictures, that's okay. You can really see the picture behind it. Our study is 355 HIV-positive or at-risk Latino substance users. As I said, 87% are Puerto Rican, 17% are HIV positive, majority is male, 67%. And I say 98% co-occurring disorders. Really, we're confident to say that 100% of our clients have co-occurring disorders. And our data collection is based on baseline surveys when the clients present for substance abuse treatment using the Addiction Severity Index and the Mental Health Screening Form 3, which is from the SAMHSA Treatment Improvement Protocol number 42. So just a little bit of background on suicidality in this population, and I'm going to use the word suicidality, and it can be operationalized to be just lifetime history of suicide ideation and or suicide attempts. If you look at the literature, we can see that among Latinos, suicide ideation can be as high as 10.2% compared to the general U.S. population of 3.7%. And then for attempts, it can be as high as 5.4% compared to the general population of 0.5%. So we already see that Latinos are experiencing higher risk. And then even more so, Puerto Ricans have a higher likelihood of suicidality than other subgroups and white counterparts, where ideation can be as high as 30% and attempts as high as 8.8%. And then sort of looking at the co-occurring population, ideation is almost 30%, attempts are 22%. So we already know that this co-occurring population, the Latino population, is sort of at this intersection of double risks. And I just want to point out a couple of risk factors for Latinos and suicide: having DSM, multiple diagnoses, substance abuse, age, being female, immigration status and acculturation level, family conflict, unemployment. And for Puerto Ricans, disrupted marital status, being single, low income, unemployment, these are all risk factors that I'm sure many of you already are familiar with. I wanted to draw your attention to an important protective factor for Latinos in suicide, and that is family and social support, which we'll look at in a second here. So our research questions are exploring the rate of suicidality among Latino substance users, looking at the relationship between severe mental health symptoms, substance abuse, and suicidality in Latinos. And I'll just say that we have used severe mental health symptoms here to mean sort of acute severe mental health symptoms aside from depression and anxiety. So we looked at having extremely strong fears, having feeling that people are against you, hearing voices or seeing things, also having a lifetime history of manic episodes or panic episodes. And then we also looked at the relationship between family history of substance abuse and suicidality. And we're looking at that because we know that the family is really important in Latino culture for, you know, one, it's important for our clients. Two, family and social supports are very important when we look at recovery. And three, we also sort of anecdotally have seen a lot of our clients report that they're actually learning, we call it substance abuse transmission, so they're having a family member in the home that's introduced them to substances. And so these are univariate statistics. Average age is 39, mostly male, I mentioned that. 62% never married, 93% unemployed. We see that more than 75% are homeless, more than 80% have a lifetime use of alcohol and cocaine, and 70% have a lifetime heroin use. And then this sort of very fascinating 80% of the clients have reported a sibling, a parent, or a partner who has a history of substance abuse or is currently using. And I really just want to, you know, our main point of this presentation is to draw people's attention to the incidence of suicidality in this population. 29% have attempted suicide, so almost a third of our clients presenting have made an attempt, and 37% have reported a lifetime history of suicide ideation. We see the higher than 80% for depression and anxiety, what we'd expect, and then also these severe acute mental health symptoms, which, you know, I think are important to just draw attention to, given that a lot of times we look at the mental health of these clients and we're looking at depression and anxiety and not these more acute hearing voices, having strong fears that interfere with daily activities, and then having manic and panic histories. And looking at our bivariate statistics, I just want to point out that, I'll just go back to this slide quickly, we ran our data using just our Puerto Rican sample, and found it, they were so similar to our whole sample that we decided to just report on our whole sample, but we feel comfortable sort of generalizing our findings to the Puerto Rican population in general, since it is our target population and it is the majority of our clients. So gender is significant with suicidality in this population. Interestingly enough, being HIV positive can be sort of seen as a protective factor in that because we know that people who are HIV positive tend to have maybe stronger services, that are more connected. And we can see that having a lifetime history of alcohol use and cocaine use are statistically significant with having a lifetime history of suicidality, although heroin use is not significant. And then that family substance abuse piece comes back up again, and we can see that these clients whose families might be using are associated with having suicidality, as is depression and anxiety, and all of the acute mental health symptoms that we looked at. So here's just a summary of what our findings are. And importantly, our implications, what we have to take home with us, is that for people who are working with the Puerto Rican or Latino population, what they're presenting with in terms of suicidality is a lot higher than what the literature has shown us in the past, and a lot higher than what we would expect. Also, that they have this very unique high rate of severe mental health symptoms, having fears, having a history of manic and panic, in addition to the depression and anxiety. And then also understanding the role of family substance abuse and looking at the individual and their relationship with their family, especially as you move forward with recovery and understanding maybe where the client has picked up substance abuse. So just quickly, I'll just talk about the limitations of our study. We would love to do more studies on suicidality causation and severity, also looking at culturally specific risk and protective factors. And of course, we would love to see more future research to look at suicidality among the Latino community substance users with co-occurring disorders. So with that, I'm going to pass it to Diliana De Jesus, who's the Deputy Director of Casa Esperanza.
Thanks, Katie. So as we wrote the grant, we knew that we had several challenges just based on our client demographics. However, once we started in the implementation, we discovered some additional challenges. Starting with the lack of screening and assessment for suicidality within addictions treatment programs. And part of that is that we really kind of envisioned doing the mental health services at an outpatient level where residential really had the staffing for substance abuse counseling. And so we had staff who didn't necessarily have the expertise, training, or credentialing to really truly assess for suicidality. And their immediate, once they screened for it, was saying, what do we do with this client? And kind of the knee-jerk reaction is they should be hospitalized, which really kind of also leads into another challenge regarding stigma, both stigma of clients that they have of themselves, but also stigma in the Latino community and amongst staff. And part of that was, so clients would underreport when they were coming in for an initial intake, because they're afraid that they would be denied admissions or that they would be forced into a hospitalization. And knowing that once we kind of finished the intake and we did an assessment, the next question is, well, now we have more information, but they actually don't have anyone that they can connect to because of the lack of access to bilingual, bicultural mental health providers. And so because there are so few bilingual mental health providers in the area, those that can connect with one, there's also a very long waiting time, and so people are not getting the services that they need in an expedient manner. And we try and kind of work around this by providing some translation services, but that also poses additional challenges. Challenges in terms of reimbursements from health insurance, translation services are not reimbursable. We were fortunate to have this grant to allow our staff to go with a client to translate. Because while they can get translation services through kind of the medical field, we recognize that that also creates a problem in terms of creating a trusting therapeutic relationship if the translator is kind of someone different every single time that they're trying to meet with their psychiatrist. And so that poses some significant challenges in terms of service implementation. And this lack of access not only affected the individual clients that we served, but also the entire family system. And so, again, as Katie was saying, 80% of our clients had a family member who had a history of substance abuse. And so really looking at what does that mean that the entire family, the generation, the cycle of addiction, no one is really able to access the services that they need. And part of the family support that comes into it is also looking at, because the large percentage of folks who come from Puerto Rico, there's a circular migration pattern. And so a lot of people, if they have family who are supportive, a lot of them are actually still in Puerto Rico and are not able to kind of provide that positive reinforcement that the clients need here in order to be successful. And so because they want that family connection, they tend to travel back to Puerto Rico, which actually has a lesser quality of care. And it's also one of the epicenters for HIV, and they tend to cause a lot of come back after they've relapsed and kind of repeating the cycle of coming back into treatment but still kind of missing that social connectedness. And so really working with what does family mean, who are the supports, how can we create a network for each client. And as we're looking at all this, the obvious and biggest challenge that we have in terms of sustainability is the lack of funding for integrated care. So this grant really afforded us the ability to truly provide our clients with substance abuse, mental health, and even bringing in some of our primary care. But looking at the big question that SAMHSA will always ask is, how do you sustain this project after the 5 years is over? And part of our struggles is then looking at, well, it's still siloed funding, which still equals siloed treatment. And there's a couple of things that we are working on in order to address this challenge and all the other ones, and I'm going to hand it off to our Executive Director, Emily Stewart, to discuss them.
Okay, thank you, Diliana. So some of the things that we did to begin to address these challenges, as Diliana said, this, you know, was a five-year grant, and so when we started, we thought we knew some things, and then as we went along, we realized that we needed to make some changes. So one thing we did was obviously immediately we increased our capacity to do on-site screening, assessment, and treatment for people who were had suicidal ideation or who presented with suicidality. That really meant a lot of training for staff, a lot of work around addressing issues of stigma, helping staff by also bringing in more folks who were had mental health credentialing, were master's level clinicians. So really integrating our addictions counselors and our mental health staff. That was really important in terms of screening and assessment. We created a system for prioritizing the identification and treatment of individuals who are at highest risk. So we really created those systems. That was important in terms of identifying those people who needed help, but it was also important in terms of giving staff the confidence that they knew that those systems were in place so that they were less skittish about working with someone who might present with suicidal ideation. We added on-site psychiatric and primary care services. And again, a lot of these things were really not intended initially with the grant. They weren't funded with the grant, but we knew that in order to be successful in working with the population and addressing these serious mental illness and suicidality, that we had to incorporate these elements. So we brought on a psychiatric nurse practitioner and psychiatrist, and we were able to provide on-site prescribing and support for medication. We established a multidisciplinary team to actually manage and coordinate the care. So instead of just providing the addictions treatment in the residential setting, we really integrated the mental health services that were available on campus, and the multidisciplinary team made up of counselors, case managers, psychiatric nurse practitioner, and master's level mental health clinicians were able to work together to ensure that people who are at high risk got the care that they needed. We focused on developing a culturally focused integrated treatment model for individuals with co-occurring disorders. One thing in particular that, you know, anecdotally we just want to mention is, you know, the high rates of misdiagnosis amongst the Latino population. And one example is just the importance of differentiating between cultural presentations around death and spirituality as opposed to psychiatric symptoms. So someone who discusses, tells someone in a session that they talked to their mother who had passed away recently, that that's not a psychiatric symptom, but it might just be a cultural expression about that person's feelings towards their mother who's recently passed away. So really being able to look at that, parse those things and understand them and know how to provide appropriate supports. And then also really looking at culture not just in terms of how Latino culture impacts expressions around suicidality, but also looking at individual beliefs, norms, and values, and how each individual brings their own cultural expressions and what role that plays in addressing suicidality. We also added psychoeducation regarding trauma, mental illness, and disease self-management. Empowering clients to understand their own mental illness was an important part of helping them to manage, and also integrating that into an overall recovery orientation. Increased services that connect clients to appropriate family peer supports. As Diliana mentioned, many people were physically disconnected from family or were disconnected from family because family may have been part of initiation of addiction. And so it was very important to help people find other supports that would help sustain them in their recovery. And then, again, increasing training for staff. Focusing on trauma-informed, person-centered care and evidence-based practice. And, again, educating our partners. That was another crucial piece to this, is that many of our peer providers or folks that we partnered with on this study did not necessarily bring the cultural competence necessary to be successful in working with the patient population. So we actually spent a lot of time working with our partners to help make sure that they actually understood the unique needs of our clients. So I'll just wrap up. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm blowing through my slides and not even...
Spacebar.
Thank you. So here we are, policy advocacy. Just very quickly, I'll talk about a few key things that we're focused on in an effort to really improve the quality of care for the clients that we serve. implementation of parity at both the state and federal level. You know, we're very pleased that this legislation is in place. Unfortunately, the Massachusetts Office of Patient Protection reported in 2010 that in the prior 9 years, the single largest category of appeals were filed with health insurance companies when they denied coverage for mental health or substance abuse care, and that more than half of the eligible behavioral health appeals in 2010 were resolved wholly or partially in favor of the consumer, and those were mostly behavioral health claims. So really we know that even with parity, that we are still experiencing a lot of disparities in terms of access to care. Also, pushing for federal legislation to designate federally qualified behavioral health homes or health centers. Legislation was introduced in February of 2013 in the Senate, and it's something that we feel strongly will help to provide the integrated funding that we need to ensure that people are getting, who are multiply diagnosed, are getting the care that they need, especially those folks with serious persistent mental illness. Also, addressing behavioral health disparities with population-specific data by implementing the recommendations from the Institute of Medicine report on race, ethnicity, and language data, collecting this important demographic data when we're looking at specific diagnoses will really help us to identify areas of opportunity for research. What are those interventions that are most effective with vulnerable populations? And of course, continuing to fight for funding for integrated care for multiply diagnosed individuals. So that's it. Thank you.